I'm Christopher Lydon in New Delhi with the global Indian Shashi Tharoor. He came home from the number two job at the United Nations in New York to run for office himself and build a political base in the South Indian state of Kerala and in the Indian Parliament in New Delhi. He won big time, and then the real fun began. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is at home in the Lodi Estates in New Delhi with a planetary politician who's taken new route on the ground. Shashi Tharoor, I find huge resonance in your story of the man who came home to get inside the real politics and has paid a price for it, felt the backlash. How do you tell the story of the United Nations politician who became the Twitter king of South Asia and the Minister of State for External Affairs? Take it from there.
Well, there's no such thing as a United Nations politician, Chris. I mean, we were all international civil servants, and that's all I was. But after,
and novelist and historian and biographer.
And all of
many
that.
Other things, too.
But after I ran for Secretary General of the UN in succession to Kofi Annan and missed it by the proverbial whisker, I
Is that a George Bush
leave.
Whisker?
That was indeed a Bush whisker, yes. The we know from John Bolton's indiscreet memoir that the U.S. vetoed me because, quote-unquote, they didn't want a strong Secretary General, unquote, which wasn't a particularly loyal thing for him to reveal in a memoir, I must admit, since his administration surely wouldn't have wanted him to admit that. But there we are. Be that as it may, the fact is that that I felt the right time had come to come back to India. And after a year and a bit of frequent visits, I decided to take the plunge and move back for good. I've always been somebody who was interested in public service. It was international public service for almost three decades, but an opportunity to actually participate in and contribute to public life in India, a country about which I had written. I mean, all my novels are set in India, and so is my nonfiction, was almost a fantasy. It was a fantasy partly because politics has been seen as a bit of a closed world for most people. Odd to say in a democracy, but I had grown up in an India where people of the conventional middle-class professional-type backgrounds went into the professions or sat the competitive examinations to enter the civil services in India. You didn't find people going into politics from the kind of background that you traditionally take for granted in most Western democracies. Instead, you had these people going into the professions or the civil services, really helping run the country, of course. But politics seemed to be the preserve either of the extremely affluent, the former Maharajas and so on who could afford it, or the ones who had nothing, what the Marxists would call the lumpen proletariat, who used politics as a means for their own personal advancement, and almost nothing in between. The only exception being the so-called traditional political families, people who had played a political role during the freedom struggle against the British and whose offspring had stayed on in politics. These were about the only categories of politicians there were. And I didn't come from a political family. My dad was a newspaper executive. I didn't have a background that entitled me to have either a godfather or any other sort of traditional appeal. And so I didn't really think this was a realistic option. But I did have a bit of a public profile, partly because of my role at the UN, which had made me fairly visible, partly because a lot of people in India chose to identify with my unsuccessful bid for the Secretary Generalship, and that gave me a lot of interest and support from the general public. And partly because of my writing, and I write in English, but my books have all been translated into Malayalam, the language of my home state of Kerala. And so I had a readership there that was aware of me beyond any official position I'd held. And so the Congress Party asked me whether I'd like to be a candidate for the elections to be held last year. And it didn't take me very long to say yes, because it was an opportunity. I knew it was the hard way of doing things, because it's one thing for somebody to come abroad or come from abroad, from a long life abroad, into a point of office, but coming into elective office was a huge challenge.
And yes, Shashi, I was confused watching it from afar whether you were the choice of the Congress Party, which it handed you, in effect, a safe district, or were you a a freelance against the tide. Whose man were you in that race?
Well, the way the parliamentary system works, you can't do that sort of outsider insurrection as you can in the U.S. If I'd come and simply run in a primary and won the party nomination, that would be something I would have enjoyed doing, frankly. But it doesn't work that way in the parliamentary system. The party decides who bears its colors, as it were, in a parliamentary race. And so, indeed, there was a challenge not so much in the party wanting me to contest, because they were the ones who invited me to put my name forward, but in which district or which constituency, as we call it, they would give me. I wanted to, as an internationalist myself, wanted to represent the capital of the state. I think that there were some elements in the party which would dearly have liked me to go to a different district where the communists had won the preceding five elections in a row, which would have satisfied everybody because it would have meant that I would have, if I'd pulled it off, it would have been a seat that no one expected to win. And if I'd lost, they would at least have had the virtue of having had the courage of putting forward this outsider as a candidate and lost a seat they were expected to lose anyway. Anyway, as it happens, I was able to make a strong case to the national leadership that I deserved to have a crack at the state capital, which was also held by the communists, but where we had at least one electoral success in the five previous elections, so it was not unwinnable, and where I also felt there'd be more of an educated readership for my books and so on, that I would be a little better known than in a rural constituency.
But surely the Congress Party recognized that they had potentially a big star, in not only in India but in the world, in Shashi Tharoor.
Well, I think that's for them to answer. I do know that that I was given all the support I could have possibly wanted from the national leadership of the party, which took an active interest in my campaign. I still remember that Mrs. Sonia Gandhi made sure that one of her electoral appearances during the election. Of course, she has all 543 constituencies around the country that she leads as the leader of the party, but she did come down to Trivandrum. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh called me during the campaign to wish me well and hope it was going well and so on. So I did feel that I had the benediction of the country's top leadership in my efforts. And I'm very pleased to say that my message did resonate well. I mean, some of my assumptions were wrong. The city itself was only 34% of my electorate. The district runs all the way to the very tip of India. In fact, I joke that it's as far as you can fly from Delhi without falling into the water. But it meant that I had a coastal belt, a fisherman, a tribal belt, a forested area, a lot of what we call Adivasis, the sort of Indian Aboriginal people, all of these. So it was really a very mixed constituency. It wasn't just like running from Bombay or Delhi. It was a very mixed constituency in terms of background, interests, issues. In many ways, a microcosm of the kinds of development challenges India faces as well. So it was a huge education. But they did indeed, I think, welcome a fresh face coming into politics. And I'm just delighted that I was able to win with the largest majority that anyone had seen in that constituency in 30 years.
And 800,000 people following your tweets as you went, right?
No, that was later. I didn't have time to tweet during the election campaign. I really began tweeting the day the votes were being counted. Which was, in fact, a month later, because our elections take place in phases. And the first phase was when my state went to the polls. And by the time the votes were counted after the fifth phase, it was a month later. But it gave me a month's breather, which I was delighted to have. And then I started tweeting as each round of counting saw my lead increase, and that was the beginning of the excitement. So I'm very happy to look back on that period now and say that those were the heady days. Some of the rougher times started soon after, because I came in perhaps somewhat naively thinking that my election mandate meant that this was support and measurable support for a different style of politics. And I tried to approach politics the way in which perhaps I had both instinctively and through my conditioning by my close observation of Western democracies, led myself to think was the right way to do it, which was to be very accessible, to speak to the press whenever they approach me, to give sound bites when sought, to tweet my opinions. Of course, I was careful. I was appointed Minister of State for External Affairs, and it was very clear that I wasn't going to use any public medium, Twitter or otherwise, to reveal any state secrets, and nor have I, nor did I. But what I discovered to my surprise was that rather than this new style being embraced, there was a ferocious backlash against it.
Well, a friend of yours described you as the embodiment of information as power. or power as information, which sort of fits nicely with the notion of information technology and the new India or something.
Well, it could have been. Certainly, I have a strong fan following in some of the IT community and so on, which is why I don't know how many of them have contributed to my 820,000 followers on Twitter. But there's no question that a lot of the young professionals and a lot of young people who are sort of wired and networked have embraced what I represent and my style and my way of doing things. But it's equally clear that a lot of people didn't like it. There were certainly many elements in the party itself, not just the opposition, but in my own ruling party.
Yeah, take that apart. That backlash. It looked like the insiders teaching the new boy a lesson.
Yeah, I think there was some of that, which is probably healthy and normal. Look, in any profession, a lateral entrant has a challenge, partly because there are people who feel they put in the hard yards for much longer. And here's somebody who's come in above them, who hasn't earned it the way they have. And that's such a normal human emotion, I really have no problem with that. But the fact is that the way in which it manifested itself surprised me. I mean, the biggest surprise was the attitude of the mainstream Indian media, particularly the television media, but eventually also the print media, which instead of actually embracing the fact that they had an accessible minister who was willing to talk and be candid within limits, but, shall we say, who represented a different way of opening up the sort of space for transparency in the process. Mm. Instead, because I wasn't playing the game by the rules that they've been accustomed to, I guess, they decided to go after me with an absolute vengeance. It got to the point where the most harmless and innocuous statements were distorted into banner headlines that a person like me, who had not only spent 29 years in the UN system, but spent, you know, 7 of those years being the voice of the UN, and what is more, the Undersecretary General who guided other senior officials around the world on what to say and how to say it and how not to say it, somebody who had appeared on every worthwhile media channel and outlet in the world without occasioning the slightest controversy, that person was caricatured within months as somebody who was constantly putting his foot in his mouth. Why? I'll give you a few examples. My first crisis was when a journalist asked me on Twitter, when our government announced an austerity drive that demoted all of us from business class to economy travel and so on because there was a drought on in the country. A journalist asked me on Twitter, "So, Mr. Minister, next time you travel, will you travel cattle class?" And I replied flippantly, "Yes, I'll travel cattle class out of solidarity with all our holy cows." Which I wouldn't have paid the slightest attention to. I sent that thing off, went off to Africa, to Liberia for a visit. And in fact, because it was a very long journey to get there, I had to fly from here to Brussels, spend some hours at the airport, then fly to Accra, spend some hours at the airport, then fly to Monrovia, and then step off the plane right into a meeting with the foreign minister. I had almost a full day away from the news cycle in India. And was horrified to discover, amidst an extremely bad internet and telephone connection, by the way, in Liberia, that I had been the object of not only hate and vilification for having said what I said, but I'd been repudiated by my own party spokespeople who said, "We are not amused," and words to that effect. I was obviously rather shaken by this because it was never meant to be. But I learned two things very quickly. First, humor does not always travel very well. But second, that in a multilingual polity, beware of the remark that can be, in my view, deliberately mistranslated. Essentially, the word went out in Hindi and Malayalam and so on that I had dismissed ordinary people, economy class passengers, as cattle. And it sounded pretty awful in Hindi and Malayalam. Senior politicians began calling for my resignation because I had, insulted the Indian public. I mean, it became one of the most, it was sort of the biggest political scandal of the month in India. And all it had been was a casual tweet. And, of course, that immediately prompted everyone to start saying, "Stop tweeting, this is the problem," et cetera, et cetera. Whereas I think most fair-minded people would suggest that the problem was the deliberate distortion of that otherwise innocent and certainly with hindsight unnecessary comment. I had a second episode when I an innocent and entirely uncontroversial observation about India's use of moralism in foreign policy under Nehru was given banner headline treatment as an attack on the founding Prime Minister of India, which it was not. And that too created a new crisis. At that point, I held a press conference and essentially denounced the press, saying that, you know, India deserves better, and frankly, so do I. Which obviously made permanent enemies out of the media that I was criticizing. And then when I was in Saudi Arabia with the Prime Minister, I made a totally banal, boring comment using a word that's very common at the UN, that Saudi Arabia would be a valuable interlocutor for us. Interlocutor is so often used at the UN, I never thought it was a word that could be misunderstood. But the Indian media immediately decided that interlocutor meant intermediary, and accused me of having thrown aside 60 years of Indian foreign policy and asked for Saudi Arabia to be an intermediary between India and Pakistan, which actually created a ruckus in Parliament. Now, I mean, it was, you know, this is three successive episodes over a matter of a few months. The net result of which was this portrait being painted of me to the political class and in the public imagination as somebody who was out of control, somebody who was a controversialist, somebody who was who had no respect for the traditions and practices that have been enshrined in many decades of Indian politics. And somebody, therefore, was basically unfit for the office he was holding. So it had become, obviously a matter of shall we say, some pain and some sensitivity by March of this year, when the final sort of nail in the coffin came up, the eruption of what was portrayed as a financial scandal relating to a cricket league. Now, there's a very popular league which, like baseball, has city teams, and where the owners bid for players from around the world. The best players around the world play in India in this particular league. And the league had three successful years and announced an expansion to include two new franchises. And I backed not financially, I don't have that kind of money, but backed as a mentor a group of people who wanted to bring a team to my home state of Kerala. I had very good reasons for doing so, apart from the fact that in our parliamentary system, it is entirely appropriate for members of parliament to attract ventures and businesses to their home states and home districts. There was also the fact that Kerala has suffered large periods of communist rule. It has a completely welfare state mentality. It is a place which has been shunned by private enterprise and industry. And I thought one way of breaking through the miasma of sloth that has in fact driven such a large number of Keralites to become expatriate labor in the Gulf and elsewhere in India was by actually creating, as it were, value in a new business, in a new exciting 21st century venture in my home state. So I had a very clear reason for doing this.
I took the commercial cricket piece of the story as part of the parable of a man in modern India. I mean, here we are with India's great game, inherited from the Brits, of course, but in a modern television world marketing kind of form. Somebody's going to make big money. It's the Indian commercial imagination at work, but again, it's a compromising, dangerous little business. And you, there was a financial piece in your story, too.
Well, the story was, the group of people who, the promoters, who actually then got together, the business people who formed the consortium that bid for the team successfully, included a friend of mine who, it is true, I subsequently became rather close to. In fact, she is now my fiancée and will soon be my bride. So I never concealed any of this from anybody. In fact, my openness was part of the problem because I went out openly with her. I was separated from my New York-based wife, and I was certainly not concealing the fact that this was a friend, a close friend. But what happened was that when this bid was successful, it thwarted the ambitions of the next couple of bidders who had very strong, very powerful political backing. Mm. And these are people who are not used to being crossed. And the result was a pretty vicious unleashing of an attack on this team. The first attempt was made by the now discredited commissioner of the league to buy off the winners by saying, give me $50 million to walk, and they wouldn't take it. Then he tried to intimidate them, and the businessmen and the consortium were summoned to a midnight session where they were browbeaten by the commissioner and a very senior political figure in order to get them to back off. They didn't give in to that either. And so the third method he tried was to discredit the team by attacking its mentor, me, as having some sort of pecuniary interest. So he tweeted, again, Twitter raised its head, he tweeted the fact of my friendship with a person in the promoting group as if there was any corruption. Of course, our media immediately latched onto this. They took her involvement in this as proof that somehow I was going to financially benefit from the success, from this team actually playing. And they concocted a figure as a percentage of the winning bid. Now, what the winning bid is actually money that the team owners have to pay to the Board of Control for Cricket in India. It is not money they're paying to their shareholders. So, in fact, the entire premise of the accusation was completely false. The second premise that was false was that I could not have misused my office to help this team win the bid, because the bids were in sealed envelopes, open, received and opened simultaneously by the authorities of the Board of Control for Cricket. It was not as if I was granting a license from my ministry that I could influence. All I was doing was steering them through the shoals, as it were, of making a bid for a team in Kerala. So I was totally confident that I would be totally exonerated on this, because I knew I'd done nothing wrong. Certainly, neither I nor my friend had received a penny from this. There's no question of anybody profiting from this association, other than my state profiting. And yes, I was unashamed about the political benefits of my being associated with a successful team coming to my home state. But to cut a long story short, I was very unlucky in the timing of all of this. Erupted during the budget session of Parliament. And in a parliamentary system, the budget is the crucial thing every year, because if a finance bill doesn't pass, the government has to resign. And we don't have a stable majority in Parliament. We are a coalition. We have slightly shorter majority. We need some cooperation from some of the many opposition parties in Parliament to get our budget through. And when the opposition seized on this media outcry to attack me, it was entirely natural that for the government, the budget was the priority. And if the dog of the opposition, as it were, had a bone to be thrown to it, I was going to be that bone. And that's why it was right that I stepped aside. I will now be accused of having called the opposition dogs, which is a vile insult in India. So please make it very clear that all I meant is the metaphor of a bone being thrown to a
You make it clear, but stop the novel right there. To this point, it's a perfect 19th century sort of saga of a man's growth to the point of a real fork in the road. Start again and tell us about what it's all about, Shashi.
No, I mean, I wouldn't want to pretend that my experience is what Indian politics is all about. Indian politics is about a lot more things than that. This is merely one sort of side story in a very large and complex drama. My bit of it had all the elements of Greek tragedy, but it's not over yet. I mean, I was elected Member of Parliament for a five-year term. And though
it
I resigned,
are.
Oh yes, I'm a Member of Parliament. The gratifying thing about all this, Chris, is that I resigned on a Sunday, and then I went back to my constituency that weekend and was mobbed by 1,000 people at the airport and huge amounts of political support. Wherever I go now, people feel that I had the courage to try and do something that others had not been willing to do, and that I was willing to pay the price for it, and that has been highly respected. In fact, even people who have not been very well disposed towards me in state politics have grudgingly said that if there were an election in my district tomorrow, I'd win with a larger majority even than the one I had last time. So in that sense, my political base has been strengthened, oddly enough, by this setback. And the fact is that there is an awful lot that can be done, both in the public discourse and in the actual political arena at home. For example, Kerala has the huge development challenges. I spoke of Trivandrum being a microcosm. It is. It's a port city with all the challenges of urban decay and overpopulation. It's got drinking water issues, infrastructure issues, sanitation, drainage issues, electricity issues. It's got, at the same time, large pockets of significant poverty, both urban and rural poverty. We have every community well represented, Christians, various kinds of Hindus of different castes, Muslims. So all the issues in a pluralist democracy like ours that involve intercommunal engagement also arise. So the challenges are enormous, and it's really a privilege to have an opportunity to be involved in them.
Shashi, everywhere I go in India, people want to talk about you, and there seem to be two lines. One, that the whole cricket incident revealed bad judgment on your part. Mm-hmm. The other view that India desperately needs a man of your scope, a man of your range, a man of your experience, your connections, not only with the Gulf, but with Africa, with New York, with the world. And may I say, all the more because Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is a man who listens carefully, but doesn't say an awful lot. There are people there are non-resident Indians in America who feel that you're kind of a test as to whether they will be welcome in the new India, whether the children of India can come home in some fashion and contribute. How do you define the issue, so to speak?
I would respectfully disagree, while accepting that very many people see it that way, and that very many have seen sort of the advantages of making an example out of me, as some have said, are that it may discourage others from following my example. I believe it will not, and that's partly because I'm aware of my own human failings and limitations. I've come into politics after, in some ways, too long a time away, and I am already today 54 years of age, which, India is the only democracy in the world where a politician of that age can be described as young, but I am apparently called young. But I think there is room for genuinely younger people with the time to learn the ropes, but with the perspective that life and education abroad would have offered them. I also think that that yes, I was guilty not only of bad luck, but also of bad judgment, in the sense that perhaps it would have been wise, well before the matters had reached that point, to get my fiancée to do what she has since done, which is to resign from the group of promoters and relinquish voluntarily her shares in that group. But at that time, she wasn't my fiancée, and at that time, I didn't feel I was entitled to demand that of her. But still, I accept that those are mistakes that somebody else need not make.
Come back to this question of who speaks for India. I keep thinking of something Amartya Sen said, recalling Krishnamenon in the 50s and 60s, I suppose, but at the UN, the longest speech on record, and the tongue of a viper. I mean, a man who with tremendous rhetorical edge and fire. But Amartya Sen said he wished that... Amartya Sen observed that when India had no power, it talked too much. As it has more and more power, he doesn't feel it's heard half enough. The question is not just who's going to speak for India, but from a position of kind of liberation, well, after all your experience, what is it the world must hear about this new India, and which your eclipse somehow frustrates?
Well, I hope the eclipse is not a total eclipse, as it were.
No.
But having
said
that,
the eclipse is a temporary, by nature.
In a paradoxical way, it has freed me to give interviews. I've been on the CNN and BBC and so on since resigning, talking about things with a freedom which a minister in the government perhaps would not be able to do. But I wasn't speaking for the government, and that is a big difference. I mean, I think Amartya's point is partly that India, as a government, does not often articulate its point of view enough publicly to the world, and I think that is a shame. And it certainly reflects the reticence that is expected in our political culture, which is very untypical of most democracies. But having said that, it's also a cultural thing. I mean, India has not traditionally respected public articulation. The strong silent type is far more venerated. But then Jawaharlal Nehru was such a great exception. He wrote torrents. He spoke fluently. He was a voice for India in the world as India's first prime minister, and he's venerated today. So I certainly hope that people would want to emulate him in the sense of being able to articulate convincingly in language and terms that foreigners can understand what India is all about. And I gave a talk at the TED conference when it came to India, which apparently has gone completely viral and has been sort of forwarded around the world many times. And the number of people I come across or who write to me who've seen it, for me, were not just an indication of how well-networked the world is today, but also of how much hunger there is about a sort of new point of view about why India matters in the world.
Amen. Amen. Give us the short form. Preach.
I think India stands for an astonishingly important experiment in the world of trying to pursue development and overcome huge problems of poverty and internal social divisions, violence, and so on, through democracy. And that is its most important contribution to the world of today. Secondly, it's been an astonishing advertisement for the management of pluralism, of a diversity that rarely can be found anywhere in the world, and that yet is being managed without tyranny, and indeed with a startling insight that people are free to be themselves, including, you know, fully covered Muslim women and turban Sikh men and people in a wide variety of clothes and so on, because the whole logic is that you can be divided by, you know, caste, creed, color, culture, cuisine, custom and costume, and even conviction, but still rally around a consensus. And that consensus is around the sort of Indian idea that it doesn't really matter whether you agree all the time or not, as long as you agree on how to disagree. And we've managed to sustain that effectively. And it's a very different example from that of China, which is rightly being admired around the world for what it's been able to accomplish, but which functions as a society and as a player on the world stage very differently from India. And I think that the world should have room for both styles and both ways of doing things, both ancient civilizations with their own cultural underpinnings that give us the contemporary reality of today.
My quick sense, Shashi, would be that there is something in this moment that calls on India. It has something to do with India's post-imperial recovery and its growth, its emotional sort of groove, and a connection with so many other parts of the world that are struggling with the same recovery. Africa first, but Latin America too, the South, the poor, the post-colonial. Would you draw a little bit on your own dealings in Africa with Rwanda, for example, and elsewhere where you sense some sort of potency in the Indian idea?
Absolutely. In fact, I didn't deal that much with Africa in my UN days. My fields of action were mainly Southeast Asia and Europe, particularly the Vietnamese Boat People crisis and the Yugoslav Civil War were my two big historic sort of epical events that I was involved in. In fact, I was dealing with Yugoslavia while Rwanda was going wrong, so I saw it happening, but it was handled by other colleagues. But having said that, as minister, Africa was my responsibility, and I traveled extensively to Africa and received a large number of African ministers and heads of state in India. And I would say that for me, it's been very, very striking. First of all, Africa represents a continent of enormous need and enormous potential. But there is a sort of global perception that there's kind of a scramble for Africa in which China is beating all comers. I would just say with all respect that we are not China. I mean, we're not there to scavenge for resources. We are certainly not doing anything as India to either directly influence African governments or tell them what to do. Our approach is very much, tell us what your needs are and let's see if we can help you sort of thing. And it's been working very well. We don't have the kinds of resources that others do to give large grants, but we do give a lot of very soft loans, practically no interest, which are being snapped up. We do have one intriguing advantage that I've discovered from talking to a very large number of African leaders, which is when the Africans look at the Western model or the Chinese, they are very impressed. They look with awe and admiration, but they don't actually see any affinity there. Whereas when they look at India, they see a country which seems to be facing many of the kinds of problems they face, which seems nonetheless, through all the chaos and difficulties, to have overcome some of them. And they feel, hey, if India can do that, maybe we can learn from them, maybe we can overcome some of our problems too, because they're so much like us. That affinity is a huge advantage to us, and it helps that India's been on the side of African freedom from the colonial era onwards, and there are lots of long-standing relationships between India and Africa.
That's precisely the connection I was imagining. But then what? What does India do with it?
What India does with it is we offer them our expertise. We encourage our private sector to go in. Again, another major difference from China is that most of India's current economic engagement in Africa is through facilitating the work of our private sector. It's Indian companies going in and building the presidential palace in Ghana, or building a railway line in Ethiopia, or constructing factories in many, many countries in the world. But it's also, for example, I'll tell you, an Indian entrepreneur has bought large chunks of land in Ethiopia to grow flowers to export to Europe. Now, that's the sort of thing that would never occur to an Indian government organization, but it's part of the sort of newly liberalized economic thrust of today's India that we're seeing. And I must say that it's a way in which India can contribute to Africa without being part of, if you like, allegations of either government corruption or statism or any of the problems that have bedeviled previous international economic engagement with that continent.
What does the game of cricket in the end have to do with it?
Cricket, Ashish Nandi memorably wrote once, is an Indian game accidentally discovered by the British, which is a line I wish I'd thought of myself, because it so perfectly accords with our national character.
Take that part a little bit. I thought it was invented in the Caribbean.
No.
and handed back with color and flavor to the Brits.
Well, the Brits obviously invented it as a game emerging from their own sort of rural English life. Even the term wicket is from the gates that were defended by the young shepherd while somebody else threw a ball at him, kind of thing, and it evolved from there. But as you know, by the Victorian era, it had already acquired an entire code. The expression "it's not cricket" had crept into the language. It stood for all that was genteel and proper and decent, and at the same time, quote-unquote, manly in the Victorian sense of the term. What has happened in the 20th and now the early 21st centuries is a dramatic transformation of many, many aspects of the game. The pace at which it's played, the honor code or lack thereof increasingly, the commercial influences on the game and emerging from the game, the transformation of the sport through colonial engagement, and finally the engagement of the former colonies is what I meant to say. And finally, the change in the power balance within the sport as a game that was run internationally for 150 years by something called the Imperial Cricket Conference, headquartered at Lord's Cricket Ground in London, is now the International Cricket Conference. It is headed by an Indian and is headquartered in Dubai because it's more convenient for Indians to travel to Dubai than to London. And they prefer the weather there, not to mention that the tax regime is more helpful. And that India contributes by far the largest chunk of revenues to the sport and therefore exercises a clout in world cricket comparable to the clout of the US and the United Nations, if not more so. Maybe the US or the World Bank might be a better analogy. So that's the way in which cricket has changed. When I was quoting the comment about it being an Indian game, all I meant is that it's a sport which, in all its respect for the vicissitudes of life, a game that is so influenced by weather patterns, humidity in the air, the pitch on which it is played, which changes from venue to venue, the luck of the toss, all sorts of factors where time, weather, luck, and various other considerations can influence an outcome. It fits in very well with a country which has always had this attitude towards life and fate, an enormous respect for the, shall we say, the quirks of human life and destiny. And the sport sort of seems to fit in with our recognition of that, including some of the perversities that life inflicts on us that can be inflicted on us through the sport as well. But it is, of course, also a game that fits in with our national talent. It's one of the very few sports in the world where any Indians have any chance of being amongst the world's best. So our build, our stamina, our instinctive skills, genetically, as it were, may accord better to cricket than to many of the other sports in which we've not excelled around the world. So all of that makes it very much the quintessential Indian sport. Officially, India's national sport is hockey, field hockey. But in practice, I think the audiences and the masses and the advertisers have all voted with their feet and their money and their wallets to for cricket.
But isn't there a resonance, too, also with the role that India might just play in the world in the next century? With this, so to speak, transnational game, this flexible instrument.
Some would say that in cricket, India has now begun to strut on the world stage, to throw its weight around, to finally exercise a level of muscle commensurate with its size and contribution and skills. But I would say that is not a good metaphor for India's role on the world stage, because India is not instinctively a country that would like to throw its weight around. We spent a lot of the decades after independence essentially trying to safeguard the sovereignty we had won after 200 long years of foreign rule and the autonomy of action that the nationalists felt they had earned the right to have by fighting for and winning their freedom. Today, we are a different country. We can take our sovereignty for granted. No one can threaten that sovereignty. We assume that our experience and our economic resources give us whatever autonomy we need, and we are now truly interested in cooperative engagement and exercising mature responsibility on the world stage. And I think that is a very different approach. We believe that we have contributions to make. We've done this, for example, at the UN throughout. India has been a leading contributor to UN peacekeeping operations. We are now on the Security Council. We are looking for UN reform, which we hope will grant us a permanent place in that body. We are proud of our membership in the G20. We know that what India has to say is by and large listened to with respect around the world. We don't need to throw our weight around to accomplish that.
Shashi Thura, I can't help remembering you as a student 30 years ago in Boston. All of this seems in some fashion foreordained. It's a great pleasure to see you 30 years down the road and to hear your account of India, not to mention just to be here. Thank you so much. I hope the conversation's not over.
Thank you. I'm sure it's not over, Chris, and look forward to keeping in touch.
Please. Shashi, thank you.
Paul McCarthy, Ben Mandelkern, and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.